There's something about putting the material of your life and the routines of your life in a poem that changes its use, right? Because all of a sudden it all becomes poetic material.
Hi, this is Bianca Stone. Welcome to the Ruth Stone podcast. I'm joined today by Bianca Stone's husband, Ben Pease.
May I speak?
And we are speaking today with the poet Ted Dodson. It would be...
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Good morning, Ted.
Good morning, Ted. And
good morning. Good morning.
I forgot your dog's name already.
Marcello. Mm-hmm.
Ted Dodson, who is the author of this beautiful new book, In Orange, is also the author of At the National Monument, Always Today, also by Pioneer Works from 2016, and Pop in Spring by Diaz, 2013. He works for Bomb Magazine, is an editor at large for Future Poem, and is a former editor of the Poetry Project newsletter. And he was also one of the first guests that we had at the free weekly Ruth Stone House Poetry Workshop 2 years ago in Brandon, Vermont, when he visited us. And Ted, thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure. So happy to be here.
And congratulations on your beautiful new book.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, totally. You're welcome.
We've been stealing it back and forth.
We have been. And Odette spilled chocolate milk on it, which Perfect. Sucks because it's a really beautiful book, but and matches your hat right now.
It does, yeah.
We've been talking a lot about manuscripts here on the podcast and at the Ruth Stone House in the bubble. I was struck at how beautifully assembled your book is and how well the poems move and speak together and converse with other poets and artists. And it's also very unique that at the end of each untitled poem, there's a date and a location noted. So I was wondering if you could start out by talking about the choice to have that be a consistent part of the book and mm-hmm. how it played a part in the creation of the poems.
Well, I mean, the first thing I'll say is, like, you know, I didn't know all these poems were going to hang together in the way that they did until they reached a certain point. And when I kind of, I was on residency at the Malay Colony. And I remember it was middle of the winter. It was negative 20 degrees outside. I was just like, you know, staring out this window at, like, you know, a winter wasteland constantly. And I wrote a poem in the book. I mean, in the little tag at the end of the poem is, you know, upstate. And I think it's like sometime in February. And it began with this line, you know, peel the orange and it's more orange, right? And I think that was the moment when after I wrote that poem, I was like, oh, okay, I think that I have a conceit that is going to string together the whole manuscript in a way.
And you're talking specifically about using the dates and the location.
Yes. I think that because that up until that point, that had just been a means of just noting, like, where I had began and written a poem. Mm-hmm. Because I wasn't, for some reason, just interested in titles or anything like that. And what I wanted to do was kind of write these poems that were kind of consuming a lot of the other writing that I had been doing at the time, like, you know, whether that's like art criticism or really,
you feel that so much in the book. I love that part of it.
Yeah. But also journaling too. So, like, it was kind of it started out as a journaling impulse, I think.
Yeah.
And you know, there are a lot of poems that are that I wrote in between all of these other poems that are in this book that just didn't make it into the book. And that, so that kind of became part of sort of the selection process, I think. There are big gaps in time in the book too. So yeah, I think that in the beginning, it was just a means of notation, and there wasn't really a driving conceit necessarily. It was just a way of producing the poems. You know, it just seemed to provide a really easy and stable means of writing, really.
Well, I feel that, but then to decide that it was important to have them in the book is a whole other thing. You know, it's like sometimes we do things in order to just do the writing, but then it disappears in the book, and so people don't really see that. But I do feel a certain amount of intimacy with it, because I feel like it places me with you in real time. In a way, like, it is really bridging the gap between poetry and essay, or even a sort of, somebody said documentaryism or something about your work, and it does kind of feel that way too.
Yeah, I think there is a documentary sort of impulse with a lot of these poems, and that comes very specifically from my love of the films of Jonas Mekas, who was, you know, Jonas captured his everyday, and that was his film. You know, he turned the camera on, you know, and made, you know, kind of the daily sort of mundane bits of his life into something that was really extraordinary. You know, he elevated, you know, street level New York City in a way I think that really very few others have done, with maybe the exception of like Frank O'Hara. You know, and so I think, yeah, the documentary impulse came directly from Jonas, but also others too. I mean, you know, Ted Greenwald's first book, Licorice Chronicles, takes a very similar form as well. The poems look very similar to these. They're spaced similarly, and they're also all dated. So I think there was some, you know, I think, precepts here. There was some, you know, sort of, I think, lineage that I was kind of tapping into in certain ways, or at least influences. You know, and but again, like I didn't, you know, I think that you were also saying something about, like, you know, this stuff could just be jettisoned. You know, why was it necessarily important to leave in? And I think that you're right in saying, like, I think it does develop a certain amount of intimacy with whoever's reading it. You're able to kind of travel along with me, and also providing a very discrete amount of time was, I think, important in that moment to me, because 2018 was a very difficult year for me. Just a lot of just like personal tragedy and things like that, you know, losing friends, losing animals, losing, you know, all sorts of things. And that actually, this book kind of came out of all of that mm-hmm. grief, really. Mm-hmm. And all of that kind of the hardship, which I sort of think I write about in a very oblique way, I think, like kind of all of us do in certain senses.
It's certainly tonally that's, you feel that in here. Yeah. It's like a sort of shadow underlying it all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My question, Ted, was riffing off of some of the elements you had talked about, is when you have this methodology you developed, how does that affect the revision process? Was it more limited, or would you, you know, these day-to-day type poems?
So that's an interesting thing. Like, you know, once I kind of hit a certain point in writing these poems, about, I think, halfway through writing what I realized was writing the book, was when things started kind of clicking together, and I started kind of revising things a little bit to kind of congeal. And yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of like how the manuscript definitely changed a lot. I mean, I say a lot. It was a lot to me. There were probably a lot of very small changes that kind of helped it to kind of hold together. But you know, I think the two big things that kind of came into play for me were that I was kind of writing this really long poem that ends the book. I started that at the end of 2018, and I started writing these poems like kind of in the very first part of the book. I think the first one is dated the beginning of 2019. I think that's right. I need to check that. 2018. I'm sorry. No, I sort of wrote the first poem is May 2018. So I was kind of concurrently writing these sort of like, I mean, also long poems, but certainly not like a long poem like the last one was. And that's when they kind of started, I started kind of seeing in the revision process similarities between the two. And I became really interested in trying to have them sort of operating on two sort of similar, but like similar scales of time, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like the last poem really echoes a lot of kind of like the gestures in the very first half of the book. And I really wanted that. And I also wanted there to be a kind of another means of kind of measurement and discrete sort of passage of time in the last poem.
Yeah.
That was more like it was happened a few different ways. It's seasonal. There you can kind of mark the time of in this sort of like cafe sort of present that's happening in the last poem. But then also, which kind of came in design and was not a part of my original idea until I talked to the designer about it, was the addition of these line numbers.
Yeah, that's so cool. I love it.
Yeah. And that
can't see, it's what is that called in copy? I'm not sure.
Lineation.
Yeah. Lineation. Yeah, I just said those line numbers. I'm sure there's some sort of word that like, you know, some biblical experts use when they're like looking up like stuff in a Bible.
Yeah. No, you get that in your Norton Critical
Edition.
Yeah.
You don't get that in like the first edition by the author.
Yeah.
Well, it gives such a seriousness to the gravity of this poem.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, now you can also be like, hey guys, all right, let's go to 83, line 55. So
Yeah, it's ready made for you know, classroom adoption, but it was a way of echoing the means of measurement that I had in the first half of the book, where everything was done by place and date, and that sort of dissolves a bit in the last long poem. Although there are obviously places and locations, and there's a lot of travel in that poem. But the discrete sort of method of measurement was on the page itself. The physical measurement was these line numbers. And that's again, like when I think about bringing together a manuscript, and when I say like, you know, there was a moment when I thought about like, there's some sort of conceit here that I can kind of build a book around. And that meant to me, like, there is a way for me to translate these poems that I'm writing into an object. Like there is a way for me to, there's a reason for me to make a book now, because the book is going to have some sort of materiality about it, that the poems mm-hmm. that it's going to like, the poems will force this book into material in a certain way. Force is probably the wrong word there, but.
They're going to bully
it. Yeah, exactly. It's going to bully it into materiality.
You can't materialize right now.
Become an object.
It's like an emotionally abusive poet poem relationship.
Yeah, that's not what I mean, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I have one last question before we have Ted read a poem. I just had, maybe because it's AWP season, I had a flashback to having a chat with James, like nonfiction. And I was just kind of listening, but he was talking about some scandal where someone had just changed like very menial details mm-hmm. in the opening of their memoir or something, and how divisive that was. And he's like, yeah, I said I did math 5 times, but I really only did it 3 times. Yeah. and how to him it was like, so, when you're nonfiction, it's so important.
Yeah, that's why it's but so much nicer to.
I'm just curious with you, Ted, in these poems that feel, you know, like the Suzanne poem, it feels mm-hmm. like a true kind of travelogue of what you're doing. Did you feel beholden to your experiences, or?
Yeah.
Did you think it was fine to kind of go off if it helped the poem in some way?
It depended. You know, I think there is a lot of fidelity in the poems. Everything that happens in the poems is true. You know, and but there are a couple of moments in a couple of poems where there is like kind of a conflation of people or a conflation of events. Like in the last long poem, there's a section about a conversation with a barista at the local coffee shop that, you know, we kind of became friends. That is a conflation of several people who worked there. And
yeah, it's just like, don't get lost in those details when you're trying to make a point, you know, like it's just,
yeah. There's some sort of line about like, don't let the truth get in the way of writing a good story or telling a good story. Yeah. And I think that's true, but, or at least I think that has some relevance to these poems, but also fidelity wasn't difficult. It wasn't difficult to maintain fidelity in most of the poems because a lot of the details are fairly mundane and there was no reason for me to bend or occlude the truth. I think actually kind of like, being truthful about to myself about like the details of my life was really important at the time. So yeah, fidelity was important in a lot of ways. And I think that like, you know, like the poem that you brought up, Ben, about Suzanne, about like listening to Leonard Cohen and kind of that list of, you know, things that I did in Los Angeles, all that is completely, completely true. But also very simple. Like I definitely was sitting at breakfast with Elaine Kahn and her boyfriend, Robert. And I looked over and then there was, I can't remember his name right now, but the guy who does the motion capture for Gollum. And he was just sitting there. He was so ripped. Oh my God. He was so jacked.
He got ripped.
Like, yeah, exactly. And see, he had like he hit.
Oh, I thought he meant he was stoned.
Oh no, maybe that.
I was like, he kind of looks stoned all the time.
Yeah.
He's my God, he was so he was like veins popping like all over his body, and in his the person he was with, I don't know if it was girl. I think he said it was his girlfriend in the book, but I really actually don't know. They just were not talking at all. Like just did not talk the entire breakfast. I was like, this is so strange. That's so weird.
I when I worked at a restaurant, I remember seeing situations like that and was like, something is like,
yeah,
fucked up or something, you know,
like, cause he was like, his like body was like jumping out of its own skin. He was like, like the whole time. So you were like, I just like, all I could see, he just looked like, an embodied just like scream the whole time. He was just like, just like
and you're like, oh no. Go back to your little child cadaver.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, speaking of ripped bodies, let's read a poem. I'm awesome. Ready, Ted. Let's get going here. Wait, Ben and I were arguing about which ones. We have opinions.
Well, Ted can also read what he wants. I mean, I had to speak gently with you, Doug, marked on 73.
Oh, sure. I can read that. And I can, Bianca, you can always tell me to read a different one later on.
Yeah.
To speak gently with you makes the whole world again accessible for a moment. The spine straightens and shoes settle evenly on the surface, counting back up from 0 to 10. Health's unlifted veil doesn't conceal what's horrible or loathsome, not amplifying what's beautiful or even insignificant to notoriety. We are occasioned with clarity, more like generosity, like closeness. Like we've hopped to the bottom of a well to gather water where it's coolest, directly from the source, only to look back up what we thought was this deep perforation in the earth and see we are still standing in the open and vibrant field of the world at hand. This is true recognition, where the thrill of words is felt when they emerge without pulling them from within and are offered from the world to the world. We are left with a memorial to this thinking space errant ideas once occupied, the dispassionate air in which small cumulative judgments were made about people and things, you know, like what I think about you. I remember the summer. It was more of a feeling than a vision. An ombre rope knotted with a variety of connections. What was just enough something to be even more nothing? There's peace and reconciliation, I hope. I keep hearing that Skeeter Davis song. It's the only one I know. The End of the World. It would be somewhat ominous, another forecast for our increasingly lubricated suck into finality. But it's a song of the immediate aftermath of heartbreak, of lost love and hopelessness, true tragedy that doesn't change or waver for 2.5 minutes. There is nothing more perfect than a song that doesn't change its mind. Romeo and Juliet are dead when the play begins. Star-crossed lovers take their life. And be watch anyway, knowing no matter what illusions or simple delights can be drawn from this work, the future is transmitted in a crystal of the present. And we are its engaged monitors, disclosing more of itself to itself. There is no sudden death, no startling violence to apprehend. Like Fulci's promise of a lathe through the eye, we see it coming. And it's like generosity, like closeness. And however struck one can be in the mirrored room of internal transfigurations, it's as Reverdy writes, the same and single voice persisting in my ear. And it's Brooklyn, November 26, 2019.
That's so beautiful. And it's, you know, I really see this film influence in the voice. It's, I can see how this, the voice in this poem actually would really lend itself to visual accompaniment. Like, I could see this being like a voiceover, just some footage. It's just got such an incredible observing mentality. It's wise. It has a certain amount of knowledge that I think is like, it's almost like it's like guide, you're like guiding us through something.
Thank you.
Well, I see it as, I mean, my take on it was that after hearing you being at the Malay Colony, I picture you sitting at a desk thinking with that hat on. I don't know. Mm-hmm. This is my internal vision of the poem. I like how the second half, we get in all this outside media, you know, the song, the quote from Everdy, and even thinking about Romeo and Juliet, it's the amount that we are given with each, and I feel like what you were saying before about dealing with these personal tragedies is very present in this poem. You know, even like why you're listening to that one song. You know, you don't get at that part, but the heartbreak in us kind of living through it And even there's just nothing more perfect than a song that doesn't change its mind. I feel like it's something even for me that is important when I'm needing music really bad. You know, like I need that song that holds a certain tone to like get me through.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think that's the last poem in the first section. So it's kind of like it ended sort of these dated poems for me. I haven't written one since then. That's like these. And I think that's because I think it's because I finished the book. Exactly. Yeah. And I turned toward all of the other sort of like writing projects and what have you that I was doing. And kind of
that you were avoiding.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of what I was saying, like, you know, there are some personal allusions that no one else would really understand, except for me in these poems. And, the one line that kind of really sticks out to me there is about health's unlifted veil. And that, this poem was published, I think, last year, I can't remember the magazine it was in right now. But as soon as it was published, people said, like, were, you know, texting me like, oh my God, this is such a crazy like pandemic poem. Like, you know, people thinking about like people wearing masks and like what have you, and this idea of like health's unlifted veil being, you know, us kind of like wearing pandemic masks or what have you. But this entire book, completely writing of it, completely preceded the pandemic. I was not considering that whatsoever. And that actually was a kind of a bit of a reference to spending time with my dad in the hospital. And that's like, you know, when I think I write about being in Georgetown Hospital in the last poem, and he was having a spinal surgery was very involved. He's older, you know, he's in his 70s, and I don't think that he would mind me saying this, but he has adverse reactions to anesthesia, and it causes a temporary temporary psychosis, really. And so it was just, you know, in those moments, it was just an extremely intense caretaking period, for me and for my mom and my sister. The effects of that, I mean, people have no idea how really, even anesthesiologists don't really know the entire function of anesthesia, like how it works. They know it just completely disassembles your consciousness, but they don't know entirely why, which is crazy. And reassembling your consciousness, it just depends on the person. Like, you know, your body does that, your mind does that itself. And for some people,
it's not just,
exactly.
That you turn on.
Wow. That's fascinating that it, in a way, like it's different for every person because based upon the mechanisms of your mind, how your consciousness works. That's really interesting.
It's great.
Is this gonna be forever? You know, like I was just thinking of that. I don't know. But it's true that people act really often very violent and angry under, you know, coming out of anesthesia.
For sure. One of the things that can happen is you just become completely dislocated from the present and from time. And especially for folks who are older, I mean, you have a lot of memories, and your mind really tries to latch on to the most palpable things that it can possibly find purchase on. And sometimes this is a lot of different things at once. And one of those things is often routine. Not to kind of go into details, but that's something that actually kind of affected me. It was like, you know, how How can I, you know, make a document of my life's routines? How can I, you know, and what does it mean to kind of put all these things in a poem? What does it mean to make material out of these things? Because the poem, for me, like in these poems, they assert a sort of kind of democratizing influence on all of these things, which I really love. And that's something that Stacey Semazik sort of gave me in like her blurb about the book. And I completely agree with her. But I would also say that, you know, there's something about putting the material of your life and the routines of your life in a poem that changes its use, right? Because all of a sudden it all becomes poetic material. And it all becomes of use to the poem itself. And for me, the poem is like, you know, is a measurement of possibility, right? Exactly. So all of these kind of, you know, mundane, routinized sort of things that you do are suddenly imbued with the entirety of the poem's possibility, right? And that's kind of where, you know, I get a really, I have a really discreet interest in image making, really. I mean, like, you know, I think these poems often kind of dissolve into more abstract sort of, you know, negative capability sort of spaces at times.
Yeah, because they are very much placed mm-hmm. in reality in a sort of yeah. phenomenological sense. Then they do, you're entirely right. Like, what I love about them so much is they will shift into the more about the image and the, mm-hmm. the abstract, the ambiguous, meditative poetry state, which is like, you know, those two parallels play off of each other and inform one another. And it's interesting because you do, there's a sort of meandering tone in your work, but it's also like super deliberate in this way. And it doesn't feel entirely random as much as like, say, an Ashbery poem would. Ashbery being slightly mm-hmm. more collage. But like, even when you talked about, you know, things that you knew about your poem that other people wouldn't in these lyrical moments, it's so important that thing that you know that we don't know, that we sort of sense mm-hmm. in the poem in those moments. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about all those things coming
together. That is a very Ashbery thing to do, I think, to kind of to be much more, be knowing about the specific, you know, personal origins of a poem, but not necessarily disclose them. You know, I think about, like, you know,
right.
Ashbery writing about, you know, his younger brother who died very, very, very early on. And there's a poem of his that, sorry, one sec, there's a dog in the yard right now. Interesting. We get all sorts of crazy animals up here, by the way. Like, you know, there's like, we have a lynx that has been coming by, and I've been afraid that it's going to eat Marcello.
Yeah, that's a legitimate fear. You gotta
nice to the hawk. But like, you know, but yeah, so like, you know, I'm trying to think of the poem. I think it might be Little J and the Prospect of Flowers, but
yeah, I know which poem you're talking about.
The Portrait of J.A. with Flowers,
that one, and a Prospect of Flowers. I think that might I want to say that that's it, or it might be. I feel like it's in Some Trees.
I remember that being like, it's definitely that poem's definitely a
yeah. And it's like, and you wouldn't necessarily know that it's about the death of his younger brother.
Right.
Because he kind of abstracts the idea.
Right. Yeah. Well, one thing I was noticing was thinking about the routine aspect. I feel like you even sort of riff off of that when you're talking about the well in this poem. You know, like we've hopped to the bottom of a well to gather water where it's coolest directly from the source, only to look back up what we thought was this deep perforation of the earth, and we are still staying in an open and vibrant field. To me, that feels like this whole process, somewhat in a way, where you're putting your routines down, and upon doing that, they become re-understood.
Yeah, entirely. Received. For sure. I think that's a really, really good reading of those lines, and kind of almost exactly I think what I mean by it. Of course, I mean, like, you know, what I mean is exactly what I say in the book, I think, too, you know, but that is, I think that's like a, you know, a fantastic interpretation of exactly that. And I think there is a lot in the book too about moments of renewed perspective and how that can change and affect an entire life of memories, or your entire life, really. How you see yourself, how you see your engagements with people, how you see your feelings as you approached others, and you know, sort of pivot moments that, you know, sort of change and recast your whole life, which I think happens more often than either we want or you know, hopefully at the exact right time.
But before we go to another poem,
well, we should wrap it up.
Okay.
With one more poem.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to ask Ted, I feel like the layout of this book is so unique. Your involvement in that, and, you know, even I always talk with our students about thinking about your poems on the page, and I know at least the chapbooks I've laid out and stuff, people usually hate it when a purposeful line will be brought over, you know, to a second.
Because it's too long.
Yeah. But I like that there's, like, even in this, you know, number one, you tell us the dimensions on the back, you know. But even with these, the width of these pages being so small, you have this like inch margin. And I don't know, just.
You have an artist.
I mean, that was all the designer. So that was one of the reasons why I really wanted to work with Pioneer Works, is because Daniel Kent, their designer who worked on my first book, he's just a total genius. And, you know, I conceptualized the design of the book. Like I would kind of most everything about the book, the dimensions of it, the construction of it, the colors, exactly what the cover was going to look like. But
I like how you're like, it was all the designer. Then you're like,
but the thing is, like, if I had tried to make this myself, it would have looked like garbage. And he did, the interiors were all him. I mean, I mean, he's just he's an InDesign genius, and he had a number of different sort of like, he actually just made like, you know, form like HTML, I guess, whatever the coding language is for InDesign, like all of these different sort of like templates for different poems, to depending on the kind of like the average length of a line, where to break it, and allow it to continue in an indented, you know, continued line below it. What is that? A hanging indent? I've also heard it called a Whitman indent.
A Whitman.
Right. I always think of Whitman. Right, because these are like, it'll be like five lines that are indented kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Necessitated, I mean, more than others, yeah.
You know, its size kind of reminded me of like O'Hara Slunch Palms, and definitely like those old small City Lights books, or just the small-sized poetry book. It felt very nostalgic, and I thought it worked really well with all your references to other poets in the book.
I would be...
But it's such a contemporary...
This is the kind of book where I would like, if I was still living in the city, I wouldn't feel like I'd need a tote bag because I could just put it in my pocket.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It fits right in the breast pocket. You know, you just take it on the subway. It's like,
that's an exciting thing for me.
It's so great.
I love that.
You mocking younger me?
No, no. I'm just agreeing with you. Read us a poem.
Sure. Do you have anything you want me to read, Bianca? I think it's your choice.
Well, I actually really loved, I think it's the second poem. It starts, to have come this far only to be reduced to do. I just love
sure.
that.
I can definitely read that.
So much.
This is the one that has the Lord of the Rings slash fiction moment. Yeah, great. Awesome. Yeah. That's one of my favorite parts of the book.
I mean, we already brought
oh, yeah,
all
for
of
sure.
them to it. Let's just finish them off.
All right. To have come this far only to be reduced to do heroically is a fitting, though limp, insurrection disguising what looked to be a better plan. Once I witnessed a clear vision and was full envy, but who would feel otherwise? The affect of lecture takes art when no one is listening, and this is by necessity. Let's talk materials. Being unrequired to ratify decency as the central non-combustible tenet of worldly affairs, courage filed alongside myth and fiction. Within this index, some of us sit with an invited guest who gifts a parcel of land tattooed in a far national corner, a lip too remote to ever reach, and this was by design. I took off my clothes so I could see my ass, see if the gym gave me any classicism, but without a mirror, I'm more or less intractable in relation to my own body's semiotics, trying to peer around the corner of myself. I just hope a man or a woman, upon finding me wiped naked across an unfamiliar coast, having vanished on an ill-fated vacation, at least say, "What a waste," then repost and enshrine my likeness as a minor cultural reference point. Could be too much to ask. Instead, I interview with a panopticon. It sees me, and all I see is a generic avatar, a little ghost or an octopus emoji. Do I have any interest in wearing a rompem, the official future outfit for stormtroopers, partying with Corona Light and a sponsored photo shoot? A bottle of rosé floats in the pool, manufactured for buoyancy. Solidarity is opted in for history, and all I have to show for it is this scam. Me and everyone I know. Do the drugs even work? I'll say I've had enough of perspective, but there are more empty rooms, empty for the sake of their emptiness, where I'd be content to wait around for a phone to ding. I'll try on that hat, again under the protective guise of a California saffron blaze, safe from the rough quenching of gathered foams and spume, lathered from chlorinated shores, appearing from the air as winsome sapphire pits. I adjust my privacy settings to include the walls of my apartment with the curtains drawn, a gratifying effort to collectivize as the Eye of Sauron, whose power thirst was a front for his voyeurism, catching Frodo and Sam bareback on the side of the Misty Mountains, pretending he didn't see, so he'd never have to stop watching. Destroyed by my lust for Hobbit Ass would be a good title for Sauron's biopic, or maybe this poem too. O'Hara wrote about not having to leave the city to enjoy greenery, also the pleasant cold of a hilltop upstate and driving up the West Side Highway, presumably. Amazed at how one's point of view translates to desire, depending on the direction of approach or the speed of arrival or the voluntary retreat of oneself to a solitary place, even if it's just the back seat of a sedan. Austerity measures your propinquity to yourself, weighing throwing us or ourselves over the side of a bridge with a view of the burning tide, gratifying our aerodynamic contours. How heavenly we could be if only we had a world where we were. That's Toronto, July 5th, 2018.
That is an absolutely fabulous poem. And this is a really fabulous book. And we are going to put a big fat link to where to buy it on our podcast show notes page. And I just want to say thank you so much, Ted, for creating this beautiful object or making sure it's out in the world and co-creating it. And yeah. And for talking with me and Ben.
Thank you both. Thank you, Bianca. Thank you, Ben. Marcello, thanks you too. it was a total pleasure. I hope you all have a wonderful day.
You as well, Ted.